An Israeli strike killed 3 sons and 4 grandchildren of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh. U.S. President Joe Biden urged Hamas militants to accept the latest proposal for a temporary ceasefire.
They need to move on the proposal that's been made.
And track and field has become the first Olympic sport to offer prize money. Today is Thursday, April 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope. 3 sons and 4 grandchildren of a Hamas political leader were killed in an Israeli missile strike. The leader, Ismail Haniyeh, says their deaths will not influence Hamas's position in ceasefire talks with Israel. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh said Wednesday that an Israeli airstrike killed 3 of his sons and at least 2 of his grandchildren. The Israeli army confirmed that it was responsible for the attack, saying all 3 were active in Hamas. The army did not say where the strike took place, but Haniyeh said it was in the Shati refugee camp where they lived. In an audio interview with the Al Jazeera news channel, Haniyeh, who is based in Qatar, said the killing of his sons would not affect Hamas's positions on a deal for a ceasefire in exchange for hostages. He said that Hamas's demands are clear and specific, and that Hamas will not make concessions on them. He said the blood of his sons is not dearer than the blood of the Palestinian people. Al Jazeera reported that the drone strike came as they were traveling in a car to visit relatives in Gaza on the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, which began Tuesday night. While Haniyeh was based in Qatar, his 13 children lived in the Shati refugee camp in northern Gaza. Unlike many other Palestinians in Gaza, they did not leave the north for the southern Gaza city of Rafah. It was not clear how the Israeli airstrike would affect the ongoing negotiations that the United States, Qatar, and Egypt are holding to try to reach a ceasefire deal in exchange for the freedom of at least 40 Israeli hostages. Israeli analyst Donna Weiss says the negotiations have proceeded slowly. She says Hamas has been delaying its response to a U.S. proposal for a deal, saying it cannot find 40 hostages that fit the category of humanitarian cases. There are 133 Israelis still being held in captivity, although Israel says at least 35 of them are dead. The patience of the families of the hostages has been running out, as they fear that time is running out to get their loved ones home alive. Meanwhile, Israel has pulled the majority of its soldiers from Gaza, but Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to insist that Israel will enter the southern Gaza city of Rafah to attack the remaining 4 Hamas battalions. U.S. President Joe Biden has grown increasingly critical of Netanyahu's handling of the war, which has killed more than 33,000 Palestinians, both gunmen and civilians, and sparked a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Meanwhile, a new poll in Israel finds that almost 3/4 of Israelis think Netanyahu should resign, either immediately or as soon as the war ends. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden urged Hamas to accept the latest proposal for a temporary ceasefire in Gaza. The terms of the deal include the release of hostages.
Now up to Hamas. They need to move on the proposal that's been made. And as I said, we'll get these hostages home where they belong, but also bring back a 6-week ceasefire that we need now.
Biden's remarks about the ceasefire come after he expressed concern about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a television interview on Tuesday. Biden said he thought Netanyahu's actions were a mistake.
I don't agree with his approach. I think it's outrageous that those 4 or 3 vehicles were hit by drones and taken out on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving there, etc.
Meanwhile, Netanyahu continues to take steps toward invading Rafah. There are nearly 1.5 million Palestinians in Rafah. Most of them had fled other parts of Gaza. We're following these stories and others from around the world. Chinese leader Xi Jinping met with former Taiwanese President Ma Ying-jeou at the Great Hall of People in Beijing on Wednesday, wrapping up an 11-day journey of peace aimed at promoting unification between Taiwan and China. The visit is the first time that a Chinese leader has hosted a former Taiwanese president in Beijing since the Kuomintang lost in the Chinese Civil War and fled to Taiwan in 1949. Search and rescue operations have resumed at a hydroelectric plant close to the northern Italian city of Bologna a day after a devastating blast killed at least 3 workers, injured 5, and left 4 missing. The deaths have stoked concerns already expressed by trade unions about workplace safety in Italy after a series of fatal accidents in factories and building sites. Enel workers plan to strike for 8 hours over the issue on Thursday. The board of Enel Group issued a statement Wednesday to express its condolences to families of victims and solidarity with those involved. The U.S. state of Ohio has voted for the winning presidential candidate in every election since 1964, except the last one in 2020. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports that Ohio now appears more conservative, presenting a challenge for the Democratic Party.
For decades, Ohio voters backed the presidential candidate who would go on to win the race. The Midwest state became a bellwether for presidential campaigns, in part because it represents much of America, says University of Cincinnati politics professor David Niven.
Ohio has a massive agriculture base and a massive manufacturing base and regional economic diversity. So it voted a lot like America because its economy was a lot like America.
Ohio voters twice chose Barack Obama for president, then backed Donald Trump in his 2016 win. But when Ohio voted again for Trump in his 2020 loss, it signaled the state's shift toward more conservative politics, says Republican strategist Bob Clegg.
The foundation was always there for Republicans to become more dominant in Ohio, but I think the Trump thing just...
Again, David Niven of University of Cincinnati.
Intensified that and made it even more so.
Voting is much more demographic-based today than it was, you know, even when Obama was in office. And those demographics, you know, point Ohio in a Republican direction. It's whiter than the nation. It's less educated than the nation. It's older than the nation.
That's a challenge for incumbent U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, who last won election in Ohio 6 years ago as a liberal Democrat.
Today, the hardworking women and men of Ohio voted to continue our fight together for 6 more years. You all showed the country that progressives can win and win decisively in the heartland.
This time, Brown is running against businessman Bernie Moreno, with Republicans looking to flip the seat and regain control of the U.S. Senate. Moreno told supporters that he wears his endorsement from Donald Trump as a badge of honor.
I wonder whether Sherrod Brown is going to wear with honor his 99% voting record with Joe Biden.
One bright spot for Democrats is how strongly Ohio voters last year rejected a Republican push to limit abortion in the state. Reproductive rights activist Veronica Ingham says the result showed that Ohioans vote outside their political parties.
Americans support abortion rights and will turn out to vote to protect these rights. Voters last night made it clear that this is not a partisan issue. Ohioans across the political spectrum don't want government involved in their personal health care decisions.
But defeating Ohio Republicans on reproductive rights may not transfer to this presidential race. Again, David Niven.
When you put core value questions on the ballot, Ohioans are mainstream moderates to liberal. They are not hardcore conservatives. But when you put candidates on the ballot, they reliably vote Republican. It's one of the odd incongruities of politics.
In this presidential race, Real Clear polling averages of public opinion polls show Trump with a 10-point lead over Biden in Ohio. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
There's potential movement with U.S. aid to Ukraine. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson told Katerina Lisanova with VOA's Ukrainian service that a plan for aid to Ukraine is in the works.
We're still working on that, as I said in there. That's going on as we speak.
The comment comes after the top U.S. general in Europe says Ukraine will run out of artillery and air defense in short order without U.S. support. Joining us is Jeff Selden, VOA national security correspondent, with additional details. So where is Ukraine right now in terms of its access to weapons? Are they running out of time? Are they running out of weapons? Where are they right now?
Well, for weeks, U.S. officials, military officials, defense officials, intelligence officials have warned repeatedly that Ukraine has been forced to ration its weapons, ration its munitions, use less than it otherwise would, because it is waiting until the U.S. and lawmakers in the U.S. approve a $60 billion security assistance package that would give them new supplies, new munitions, so that they could keep up the pace in terms of repelling Russian attacks. And on Wednesday, the commander of U.S. European Command, who oversees U.S. forces in Europe and is responsible with looking at the security situation in Europe for the U.S., gave lawmakers on the House Armed Services Committee a very stark, a very blunt assessment of where things are. And he said that not only does Russia create a chronic threat, but that Ukraine essentially is on the brink. He said that while he can't predict the future, he said, quote, "I can do simple math." And he said that if U.S. does not continue to support Ukraine, Ukraine will run out of artillery and shells and out of air defense interceptors, the munitions they need to repel Russian attacks in the air. He said, quote, "in fairly short order." And he said, in his experience, if one side can shoot and the other side can't shoot back, he said, quote, "the side that can't shoot back loses." And he said that that is accelerating rapidly right now for Ukraine. Right now they're being outshot by the Russians 5-1, he said, in a matter of weeks. And he said, this isn't a hypothetical, Russia will be able to outshoot Ukraine 10-1. And then it's only a matter of time before Russia prevails in this conflict.
It seems like at the top, U.S. President Joe Biden, Senator Chuck Schumer, Speaker Mike Johnson, they all seem to see the necessity and the urgency behind this. But what is the delay in actually getting the funding done? Isn't Mike Johnson supposed to bring the funding to a vote? What is with the slowdown here?
Well, it really comes down to what the Speaker of the House, Republican Mike Johnson, is willing or is not willing to do. And thus far, he's been unwilling to bring this security assistance package, which was passed by lawmakers in the U.S. Senate back in February. He's refused to bring it to the floor to a vote. Now, in the House Armed Services Committee, the chairman of the committee, the vice chairman, Republicans and Democrats, there's a good deal of bipartisan support for approving that legislation, approving the package so that the president can sign it and the aid can go to Ukraine. But there are a small number of Republicans who are very much against this package. They have a variety of concerns, a variety of complaints. One of the lawmakers during the hearing was arguing that, you know, it seems that unfair that the U.S. is so concerned about securing Ukraine's borders when it is not doing, in his opinion, nearly enough to secure its own borders from the threats that are trying to come across. Other lawmakers have talked about finding other ways to get Ukraine aid. But the message from General Cavoli, General Christopher Cavoli, the commander of U.S. European Command, from other defense officials, is that time is running out. And there is no one else that can provide Ukraine with the assistance that it needs. That while European allies, European partners have done quite a bit to provide Ukraine with tanks, munitions, and other weapons, when it comes to the type of artillery that Ukraine desperately needs, and when it comes to resupplying the air defense systems, the only country in the world that can provide that right now is the U.S. And so that if the U.S. doesn't provide it, eventually the clock will run out and Ukraine's ability to resist Russia will evaporate.
So as of right now, what is the capability of Russia in terms of the war in Ukraine?
Well, U.S. officials have said Russia has been hit hard. It's been taken by surprise in the fact that a military offensive it thought would last days is now well into its second year, and that Russia has suffered, just in terms of its forces, some 315,000 casualties in the fight so far. But U.S. officials also say that because Putin is obsessed with taking Ukraine, that this is not a threat that's going to evaporate. And military officials with European Command have said now that even though Russia has taken losses on the land side, their air capabilities, most of their naval capabilities, with the exception of the Black Sea, remain intact. Their nuclear capabilities, Russia is still finding ways to put money into that to modernize those capabilities. And so that overall, the Russian threat remains, and it is one that is significant.
Jeff Selden, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Finland and NATO are also in talks about aid for Ukraine. Finnish President Alexander Stubb met with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
Moscow needs to understand that they cannot wait us out, and therefore a package for Ukraine with predictable, robust support is what we are working on now in NATO. And I thank you, President, for Finland's strong support to step up the NATO support to Ukraine.
Meanwhile, Russia continues its strikes in Ukraine, the latest in the Odessa district Wednesday evening, killing four people, including a 10-year-old girl, according to the regional governor. Amid increasing worries in the Asia-Pacific region about China's long-term intentions toward its neighbors, U.S. President Joe Biden hosted Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida at the White House on Wednesday. Details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
At a White House Rose Garden news conference, President Biden announced the formation of a trilateral air defense network amid growing concern about China's rising military.
Japan and the United States and Australia will create a network system of air, missile, and defense architecture.
Alongside Biden, Japan's Prime Minister Kishida told reporters he intends to strengthen his country's defense forces through acquisition of counterstrike capabilities and increasing the military's budget. The two leaders on Thursday are to be joined by the President of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., for a summit. Their talks are to focus on how they can better protect the Philippines as China more aggressively asserts its territorial claims in the South China Sea. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope. A sudden hike in electricity rates in Africa's most populous country, Nigeria, has sparked a backlash. Critics said the decision will hurt hundreds of thousands of small businesses that rely on electricity to operate. Timothy Obizu reports from Abuja.
Until now, Jude Okafor has spent an average $25 on electricity to run a frozen fish and meat business that he started in 2021. But since last week, when the government announced a rate hike of nearly 300% for electricity, Okafor says running his business has been tough.
There is no escape. Light has gone high, fuel has gone high, and for a businessman like me, there is no way we can cope with that. If there is no light to ice our fish, and there is no fuel to fuel our gen to ice our fish, what are we going to do? Our business is running down like this is a first class act of wickedness.
The Nigerian Electricity Regulatory Commission, or NERC, announced the price change last Wednesday and said only its bigger power consumers, about 15% of consumers overall, would be affected. Authorities said consumers in that category enjoy up to 20 hours of electricity a day and that the hike was only fair to customers who receive fewer hours of light. The decision is part of President Bola Tinubu's reform drives to ease pressure on the economy. Authorities argue the state-controlled electricity rates are too low to attract new investors or allow distribution firms to recover their costs, leaving the sector with huge debts. Economic analyst Ogo Okidi says the government's move is a good one.
The government is not able to pay those subsidies on time. And because they are not able to pay those subsidies on time, the gas companies are withdrawing their gas supplies. The timing is right. I think the government has waited till April to do this, because they expect power supply to improve from now because of rainy season.
But the decision is being criticized by many, including businesses, manufacturers, and workers' unions. This week, the Abuja chapter of the Nigerian Chamber of Commerce and Industry said the decision would threaten the survival of many thousands of businesses already struggling to cope with soaring inflation. Dele Oye is national president of the Association of Nigerian Chambers of Commerce and Industry.
First of all, the timing is wrong. We all know that electricity is underpriced. But to some extent, there must be some level of subsidy. There's no way in the world there's not any form of subsidy. We cannot compete if we have to pay everything at market value when we don't receive market value service from the government. We do our roles. We do our security as investors.
Nigeria last revised electricity rates 4 years ago. Authorities say the country could save up to $2.6 billion from the subsidy removal. But a similar reform applied on petrol last year worsened the cost of living crisis for many Nigerians after the annual rate of inflation rose to more than 30%, its highest level in 3 decades. Critics will be watching to see how this newest subsidy removal unfolds. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Nasarawa State, Nigeria.
At the Paris Olympics, track and field is set to become the first sport to offer prize money to champions, upwards of $50,000. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan reports.
The 48 athletics gold medalists at the Paris Olympic Games this year will receive prize money for the first time, ending a 128-year tradition. The $50,000 reward from World Athletics is a major shift as the modern games started as an amateur event and the International Olympic Committee does not award prize money. He says there had been no discussion with the Olympic Committee except a heads up shortly before announcing the $2.4 million prize pot.
You know, commendably, they make sure that as the Olympic movement grows, that the beneficiaries of growth are the sports and ultimately the athletes. So I think this sits firmly behind those principles and philosophies that they espouse as well.
The IOC says it redistributes 90% of its income to sports bodies and says it's up to each international federation and National Olympic Committee to determine how to best serve their athletes and development.
Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
April 7th marked the six-month anniversary of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that began with the horrific Hamas-led attack on Israeli civilians. At the same time, Hamas took 250 Israelis and other foreign nationals hostage. Since then, the fighting has continued mostly in Gaza. Those 6 months of belligerence have so far cost the lives of some 1,200 Israelis and foreign nationals in Israel. In Gaza, over 32,000 people have been killed and over 75,000 injured. The fighting has also claimed the lives of 224 humanitarian aid personnel working to prevent a famine in Gaza. This includes 7 members of the World Central Kitchen who died on April 1st due to 3 Israeli airstrikes on their clearly marked convoy. The United Nations has affirmed the imperative of protecting personnel, said John Kelly, United States political minister counselor at the UN. Tragically, this has not been heeded by the parties in Gaza.
The United States is outraged and heartbroken at the deaths of these individuals who were providing food to starving civilians in the middle of a war. These workers were brave and selfless. They show the best of what humanity has to offer when the going really gets tough.
Moreover, this was not a standalone incident. This conflict has been one of the worst in recent memory in terms of the number of aid workers who have been killed, said Ambassador Kelly.
As President Biden conveyed to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on April 4th, Israel must announce and implement a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by Israel's immediate action on these steps.
We also continue to do all we can to help deliver humanitarian assistance to Palestinian civilians in Gaza through all available means, said Ambassador Kelly.
But these actions are not enough to meet the needs of the Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Humanitarian assistance is desperately needed now, and it must be facilitated to mitigate the impact of an impending famine. Gaza's entire population knows acute levels of food insecurity. Gaza's entire population is in need of humanitarian assistance.
An immediate ceasefire is essential to stabilize and improve the humanitarian situation and protect innocent lives, said Ambassador Kelly. We have urged Prime Minister Netanyahu to empower his negotiators to conclude a deal without delay to bring the hostages home. We urge Hamas as well to accept the deal on the table.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.